harbor, bustling with clipper ships unloading, dock workers and coolies hauling freight, Mahout coaxing megadonts to greater labor as pallets come off the clippers and are loaded on huge Laotian rubber-wheeled wagons for transit to the warehouses. Reminders of her former life litter the view. A smudge on the horizon marks the quarantine zone of Koh Angrit, where Gaijin traders and agricultural executives squat amid stockpiles of calories, all of them waiting patiently for a crop failure or plague to beat aside the kingdom's trade barriers. Gendosama once led her to that floating island of bamboo rafts and warehouses, stood on its gently rolling decks and had her translate as he confidently sold the foreigners on advances in sailing technologies that would speed a shipment of patented soy pro around the world. Emiko sighs and ducks under the draped lines of sisin that top the levee. The sacred thread runs down the seawall in both directions, disappearing into the distance. Every morning the monks of a different temple bless the thread, adding spiritual support to the physical defenses that push back the hungry sea. In her former life, when Gendo-sama provided her with permits and indulgences to move inside the city with impunity, Emiko had the opportunity to see the yearly blessing ceremonies of the dikes and pumps and the sai-sin that connects it all. As the first monsoon rains poured down on the assembled people, Emiko watched her revered majesty, the child queen, pull the levers that set the divine pumps roaring to life, her delicate form dwarfed by the apparatus that her ancestors had created. Monks chanted and stretched fresh sisin from the city pillar, the spiritual heart of Krung Thep, to all of the 12 coal-driven pumps that ringed the city, and then they had all prayed for the continued life of their fragile city. Now, in the dry season, the sisin looks ragged and the pumps are largely silent. The floating docks and their barges and skiffs bob softly in the red sunlight. Emiko makes her way down into the bustle, watching faces, hoping to spy someone who seems kind. She watches people pass, keeping her body still so that she does not betray her nature. Finally steals herself. She calls out to a passing day laborer.
Katorka, please, Kun, can you tell me where I might purchase ferry tickets north?
The man is covered with the powder and sweat of his work, but he smiles, friendly. How far north? She hazards a city name, unsure even if it will be close enough to the place the Gaijin has described.
Pitsanulok.
He makes a face. There's nothing going that far. Not much past Ayutthaya. The rivers have gotten too low. Some people are using muleys to pull their way north, but that is all. Some kingspring skiffs. And the war... He shrugs. If you need to go north, the roads will be dry for a while yet. She masks her disappointment and whys carefully. No river, then. By road or nothing. If she could go by river, then she would also have a way to cool herself... By road, she imagines the long distance through the tropic blaze of the dry season. Perhaps she should wait for the rainy season. With the monsoon, the temperatures will fall and the rivers rise. Emiko starts back over the seawall and down through the slums that house dock families and de-quarantined sailors on shore leave. By road, then. It was foolish even for her to go looking. If she could get aboard a Kingspring train, but that would require permits, many, many permits, just to get aboard. But if she could bribe someone, stow away, she grimaces. All roads lead to Raleigh. She will have to speak with him, to beg the old crow for things he has no reason to give. A man with dragon tattoos on his stomach and a takra ball tattooed on his shoulder gawks at her as she walks past.
Hichikichi, he murmurs.
Emiko doesn't turn at the words, but her skin prickles. The man follows her.
Hichikichi,
he says again. She glances back. His face is unfriendly. He's missing a hand as well, she's horrified to notice. He reaches out with a stump and prods her shoulder. She jerks away. Stutter-stop reaction, betraying her nature. He smiles, and his teeth are black with betel nut. Emiko turns down a soy, hoping to escape his attention. Again he calls after her.
Hichikichi!
Emiko ducks into another winding squeezeway, breaks into a faster walk. Her body warms. Her hands become slick with sweat. She pants rapidly, trying to expel the increasing heat. Still, the man follows. He doesn't call out again, but she hears his footsteps. She makes another turn. Cheshire scatter before her, shimmers of light flushed like cockroaches. If only she could evaporate as they do, fade against a wall and let this man slide past.
Where are you going, wind up?
The man calls.
I just want to get a look at you.
If she was still with Gendo-sama, she would face this man, would stand confident, protected by import stamps and ownership permits and consulates and the awful threat of her master's retribution. A piece of property, true, but respected nonetheless. She could even go to a white shirt or the police for protection. With stamps and a passport, she was not a transgression against niche and nature, but an exquisite, valued object. The alley opens onto a new street full of gaijin warehouses and trading fronts. But the man grabs her arm before she can reach it. She's hot, already flushed with a rising panic. She stares at the street longingly, but it is all shacks and dry goods and a few gaijin who will be no help for her. Grahamites are the last people she wishes to encounter. The man drags her back into the alley.
Where do you think you're going, wind up?
His eyes are bright and hard. He's chewing something. An amphetamine stick. Yaba. Coolie laborers use them to keep working, to burn calories that they do not have. His eyes sparkle as he grips her wrist. He pulls her deeper into the alley, out of sight. She's too hot to run. There is nowhere to go, even if she did.
Stand against the wall, he says.
No,
he shoves her around.
Don't look at me.
Please.
A knife appears in his good hand, glinting.
Shut up,
he says.
Stay there.
His voice has the power of command, and despite her better instincts, she finds herself obeying.
Please, just let me go,
she whispers.
I fought your kind, in the jungles in the north. Wind-ups everywhere, Hichikichi soldiers.
I am not that kind,
she whispers.
Not military.
Japanese, same as you. I lost a hand because of your kind, and a lot of good friends.
He shows her the stump where his hand is missing, pushes it against her cheek. His breath gusts hot in her nape as he wraps his arm around her neck, pressing the knife to her jugular, indenting the skin.
Please, just let me go.
She presses back against his crotch.
I'll do anything.
You think I'd soil myself that way?
He shoves her hard against the wall, making her cry out.
With an animal like you?
A pause then.
Get down on your knees.
Out on the street, cycle rickshaws clatter over cobbles. People call out, asking about the price of hemp rope and whether anyone knows the time of the Lumpini Muay Thai fight. The knife hooks around her neck again, finds her pulse with its point.
I saw my friends all die in the forests because of Japanese wind-ups.
She swallows and repeats softly,
I am not that kind.
He laughs.
Of course not. You're some other creature. Another one of their devils like they keep in their shipyard across the river. Our people are starving, and your kind take their rice.
The blade presses against her throat. He will kill her. She is sure of it. His hatred is great, and she is nothing but trash. He is high and angry and dangerous, and she is nothing. Even Gendo-sama couldn't have protected her from this. She swallows, feeling the blade press against her Adam's apple.
Is this how you will die? Is this what you were meant for? To simply be bled out like a pig?
A spark of rage flickers. An antidote to despair.
Will you not even try to survive? Did the scientists make you too stupid even to consider fighting for your own life?
Emiko closes her eyes and prays to Mizuko Jizo Bodhisattva, and then the Bakeneko Cheshire Spirit for good measure.
She takes a breath, and then, with all her strength, she slams her hand against the knife. The blade slices past her neck, a searing line.
Araiwa!
The man shouts. Emiko shoves hard against him and ducks under his flailing knife. Behind her, she hears a grunt and thud as she bolts for the street. She doesn't look back. She plunges into the street, not caring that she shows herself as a wind-up, not caring that in running she will burn up and die. She runs, determined only to escape the demon behind her. She will burn, but she will not die passive like some pig led to slaughter. She flies down the street, dodging pyramids of durian and hurtling over coiled hemp ropes. This suicidal flight is pointless, yet she will not stop. She shoves aside a gaijin haggling over burlap sacks of local Utex rice. He jerks away, crying out in alarm as she flashes past. All around, the traffic of the street seems to have slowed to a crawl. Emiko weaves under the bamboo scaffolding of a construction site. Running is strangely easy. People move as if they're suspended in honey. Only she is moving. When she glances behind her, she sees that her pursuer has fallen far behind. He's astonishingly slow. Amazing that she even feared him. She laughs at the absurdity of this suspended world. She slams into a laborer and goes sprawling, taking him down as well. The man shouts,
Araiwa! Watch where you're going!
Emiko forces herself up to her knees, hands numb with abrasions. She tries to stand, but the world tilts, blurry. She collapses, pushes upright again, drunken, overwhelmed by the furnace heat within her. The ground tilts and rotates, but she manages to stand, leans against a sun-baked wall as the man she hit shouts at her. His rage washes over her, meaningless. Darkness and heat are closing in on her. She's burning up. Out in the street, in the tangle of muley carts and bicycles, she catches sight of a gaijin face. She blinks away the closing darkness, stumbles forward a step. Is she mad? Does the Bakeneko Cheshire toy with her? She clutches the shoulder of the man who is shouting at her, staring into the traffic, searching to confirm what her boiling brain has hallucinated. The laborer cries out and recoils from her touch, but she barely notices. Another flash of the face in the traffic.
It's the gaijin.
The scarred, pale one from Raleigh's place. The one who told her to go north. His rickshaw shows briefly before disappearing behind a megadont. And then he's there again, on the other side, looking toward her. Their eyes lock. The same man. She's sure of it.
Grab her! Don't let that Hichikichi get away!
Her attacker, shouting and waving his knife as he clambers through bamboo scaffolding. She's amazed that he's so slow, so much slower than she would have expected. She watches, puzzled. Perhaps he is also crippled from his time in the war, but no, his gait is correct. It's just that everything around her is slow. The people, the traffic. Odd. Surreal and slow. The laborer seizes her. Emiko lets herself be dragged, scanning the traffic for another glimpse of the gaijin. Did she hallucinate? There. The gaijin again. Emiko throws off the laborer's grasp and lunges into traffic. With the last of her energy, she ducks under the belly of a megadont, nearly crashing into its great columnar legs, and then she's on the other side, pacing the gaijin's rickshaw, reaching up to him like a beggar. He observes her with cold eyes, completely detached. She stumbles and grabs at the rickshaw to steady herself, knowing he will shove her back. She is nothing but a wind-up. She was a fool. She was stupid to hope that he would see her as a person, a woman, as anything other than awful. Abruptly, he grabs her hand and pulls her aboard. The gaijin shouts at his driver to ride, Gangui chiche, quai, 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 to hurry up. He spews words in three different languages, and then they are accelerating, but slowly. Her attacker leaps onto the rickshaw. He slashes her shoulder. Emiko watches as her blood sprays the seat. Jewel droplets suspended in sunlight. He raises the knife again. She tries to lift a hand to defend herself, to fight him off, but she's too tired. She's limp with exhaustion and heat. The man slashes again, screaming. Emiko watches the knife descend, a movement as slow as honey poured in winter. So slow. So far away. Her flesh tears. Heat, blur, and exhaustion. She's fading. The knife descends again. Suddenly the gaijin lunges between them. A spring gun gleams in his hand. Emiko watches, vaguely intrigued that the man carries a weapon, but the fight between the gaijin and the yaba addict is so very small and far away. So very, very dark. Heat swallows her. Chapter 10. The wind-up girl does nothing to defend herself. She cries out but barely flinches as the knife bites.
Bye!
Anderson shouts to Lao Gu.
Quai, quai, quai!
He shoves the attacker away as the cycle lurches forward. The Thai man hacks clumsily at Anderson, then goes after the wind-up girl again, slashing. She does nothing to escape. Blood spatters. Anderson yanks a spring pistol from beneath his shirt and shoves it into the man's face. The man's eyes widen. He drops off the rickshaw, running for cover. Anderson follows him with the barrel, trying to decide if he should put a disc in the man's head or let him escape. But the man ducks behind a megadont wagon, robbing him of the decision.
God damn it!
Anderson peers through the traffic, making sure the man is truly gone, then shoves his pistol back under his shirt. He turns to the slumped girl.
You're safe now.
The wind-up lies inert, clothes slashed and disarrayed, eyes closed, panting rapidly. When he presses his palm to her flushed forehead, she flinches and her eyelids flutter. Her skin is scalding. Listless black eyes stare up at him.
Police,
she murmurs. The heat in her skin is overwhelming. She's dying. Anderson yanks her jacket open, trying to vent her. She's burning up, overheated by her flight and poor genetic design. Absurd that anyone would do this to a creature. Hobble it so. He shouts over his shoulder, Lao Gu! Go to the levees! Lao Gu glances back, uncomprehending.
Shui! Water! Nam! The ocean, damn it!
Anderson motions toward the dike walls.
Quickly! Quai, quai, quai!
Lao Gu nods sharply. He stands on his pedals and accelerates again, forcing the bike through the clotted traffic, calling out warnings and curses at obstructing pedestrians and draft animals. Anderson fans the wind-up girl with his hat. At the levee walls, Anderson throws the wind-up girl over his shoulder and hauls her up uneven stairs. Guardian Naga flank the stairs, their long, undulating snake bodies guiding him upward. Their faces watch impassive as he staggers higher. Sweat drips in his eyes. The wind-up is a furnace against his skin. He tops the levee. Red sun burns against his face, silhouetting drowned Tonbury across the waters. The sun is almost as hot as the body draped over his shoulder. He stumbles down the other side of the embankment and heaves the girl into the sea. The splash soaks him with salt water. She sinks like a stone. Anderson gasps and lunges after her sinking form. You fool, you stupid fool. He catches a limp arm and drags her body up from the depths, holds her so that her face floats above the waves, bracing himself to keep her from sinking again. Her skin burns. He half expects the sea to boil around her. Her black hair fans out like a net in the lapping waves. She dangles in his grasp. Lao Gu jostles down beside him. Anderson waves him over.
Here! Hold her!
Lao Gu hesitates.
Hold her, damn it! Juata!
Reluctantly, Lao Gu slides his hands under her arms. Anderson touches her neck, feeling for a pulse. Is her brain already cooked? He could be trying to revive a vegetable. The wind-up's pulse whirs like a hummingbird's, faster than any creature her size should run. Anderson leans down to listen to her breathing. Her eyes snap open. He jerks away. She thrashes and Lao Gu loses his grip. She disappears underwater.
No!
Anderson lunges after her. She surfaces again, thrashing and coughing and reaching for him. Her hand locks on his and he pulls her to the bank. Her clothes swirl about her like tangled seaweed and her black hair glistens like silk. She stares up at Anderson with dark eyes. Her skin is suddenly, blessedly, cool.
Why did you help me?
Methane lamps flicker on the streets, turning the city ethereal shades of green. Darkness has fallen, and the lampposts hiss against the blackness. Humidity reflects on cobbles and concrete, gleams on people's skin as they lean close around candles in the night markets. The wind-up girl asks again,
Why?
Anderson shrugs, glad the darkness hides his expression. He doesn't have a good answer himself. If her attacker complains of a farang and a wind-up girl, it will trigger questions and attract white shirts to him. A foolish risk, considering how exposed he already finds himself. He's far too easy to describe, and it's not far from where he found the girl to St. Francis's, and from there to more uncomfortable questions. He forces down his paranoia. He's as bad as Hak Sung. The Nak Lang was obviously high on Yaba. He won't go to the white shirts. He'll slink away and lick his wounds. Still, it was foolish. When she fainted in the rickshaw, he was sure that she was about to die, and a part of him had been glad, relieved that he could take back that moment when he recognized her and, against all his training, tied his fate to hers. He glances over at her. Her skin has lost its terrifying flush and furnace heat. She holds the remnants of slashed clothes around her, keeping her modesty. It's pitiable, really, that a creature so utterly owned clings to modesty.
Why?
She asks again. He shrugs again. You needed help.
No one helps a wind-up.
Her voice is flat.
You are a fool.
She pushes damp hair away from her face. A surreal stutter-stop motion, the genetic bits of her unkinking. Her smooth skin shines between the edges of her slashed blouse, the gentle promise of her breasts. What would she feel like? Her skin gleams, smooth and inviting. She catches him staring.
Do you wish to use me?
No. He looks away, uneasy. It's not necessary.
I would not fight you,
she says. Anderson feels a sudden revulsion at the acquiescence in her voice. On another day, at another time, he probably would have taken her for the novelty, thought nothing of it. But the fact that she expects so little fills him with distaste. He forces a smile. Thank you. No. She nods shortly. Looks out again at the humid night and the green glow of the street lamps. It's impossible to say if she is grateful or surprised, or if his decision even matters to her. However her mask might have slipped in the heat of terror and relief of escape, her thoughts are carefully locked away now. Is there some place I should take you? She shrugs.
Raleigh. He is the only one who will keep me.
But he wasn't the first, was he? You weren't always. He trails off. There's no polite word, and looking at the girl, he doesn't have the appetite to call her a toy. She glances over at him, then out again at the passing city. Gaslights puddle the street with low green pockets of phosphor, separated by deep canyons of shadow. They pass under a lamp, and Anderson catches her face, dimly illuminated, humidity sheened and pensive, before it disappears again in darkness.
No. I was not always this way.
Not. She trails off. Not.
Like this.
She falls quiet. Thoughtful.
Mishimoto employed me. I had,
she shrugs,
an owner at the company. I was owned. Again, my owner acquired a temporary foreign business exemption to bring me to the kingdom. A 90-day permit. Extendable by palace waiver because of the Japanese friendship. I was his personal secretary. Translation, office management, and companion.
Another shrug, more felt than seen.
But it is expensive to return to Japan. A dirigible ticket for a new person is the same as for your kind. My owner concluded that leaving his secretary in Bangkok was more economical. When his assignment here ended, he decided to upgrade new in Osaka.
Jesus and Noah.
She shrugs.
I was given my final pay at the ankle pad, and he went away. Up and away.
And now, Raleigh. He asks. Again the shrug.
No Thai wants a new person for secretary or translation. In Japan, okay. Come on, even. Too few babies born. Too much working needed. Here.
She shakes her head.
Kauri markets are controlled. Everyone is jealous for you techs. Everyone protects their rights. Raleigh does not care. Raleigh likes novelty.
The clouded scent of fish frying washes over them, greasy and cloying. A night market, full of people dining by candlelight, hunched over noodles and skewers of octopus and plates of lop. Anderson stifles an urge to raise the rickshaw's rain hood and close the privacy curtain to hide the evidence of her company. Walks flame brightly with the telltale green sparkles of Environment Ministry-taxed methane. The sweat sheen on the people's dark skins is barely lit. At their feet, Cheshire circle, alert for charity scraps and opportunities for theft. A Cheshire shadow bleeds across the darkness, causing Lao Gu to swerve. He curses softly in his own language. Emiko laughs, a small surprised sound, as she claps her hands in delight. Lao Gu glares back at her. You like Cheshire's? Anderson asks. Emiko looks at him in surprise.
You do not?
Back home, we can't kill them fast enough. He says, even Grahamites offer bluebills for their skins. Probably the only thing they've ever done that I agreed with.
Yes.
Emiko's brow wrinkles thoughtfully.
They are too much improved for this world, I think. A natural bird has so little chance now.
She smiles slightly.
Just think, if they had made new people first.
Is it mischief in her eyes, or melancholy? What do you think would have happened? Anderson asks. Emiko doesn't meet his gaze, looks out instead at the circling cats amongst the diners.
Jean Ripper's learned too much from Cheshire's.
She doesn't say anything else, but Anderson can guess what's in her mind. If her kind had come first, before the Jean Rippers knew better, she would not have been made sterile. She would not have the signature tick-tock motions that make her so physically obvious. She might have even been designed, as well as the military wind-ups now operating in Vietnam, deadly and fearless. Without the lesson of the Cheshires, Emiko might have had the opportunity to supplant the human species entirely with her own improved version. Instead, she is a genetic dead end, doomed to a single life cycle, just like Soy Pro and Total Nutrient Wheat. Another shadow cat bolts across the street, shimmering and shading through darkness. A high-tech homage to Lewis Carroll. A few dirigible and clipper ship rides, and suddenly entire classes of animals are wiped out, unequipped to fight an invisible threat. We would have realized our mistake. Anderson observes.
Yes. Of course. But perhaps not soon enough.
She changes the subject abruptly, nods at a temple rising against the night skyline.
It's very pretty, yes? You like their temples?
Anderson wonders if she has changed the subject to avoid conflict and argument, or if she is actually afraid that he will successfully refute her fantasy. He studies the rising chedi and baht of the temple. It's a lot nicer than what the Grahamites are building back home.
Grahamites.
She makes a face.
So concerned with niche and nature, so focused on their Noah's Ark, after the flood has already happened.
Anderson thinks of Hag, sweating and distressed at the destruction caused by Ivory Beetle. If they could, they'd keep us all on our own continents.
It is impossible, I think. People like to expand, to fill new niches.
The temple's golden filigree shines dully under the moon. The world truly is shrinking again. A few dirigible and clipper rides, and Anderson clatters through darkened streets on the far side of the planet. It's astounding. In his grandparents' time, even the commute between an old expansion suburb and a city center was impossible. His grandparents used to tell stories about exploring abandoned suburbs, scavenging for the scrap and leavings of whole sprawling neighborhoods that were destroyed in the petroleum contraction. To travel 10 miles had been a great journey for them. And now look at him. Ahead of them, white uniforms materialize at the mouth of an alley. Emiko blanches and leans close.
Hold me.
Anderson tries to shake her off, but she clings. The white shirts have stopped, are watching them approach. The wind-up clings more tightly. Anderson fights an urge to shove her from the rickshaw and flee. This is the last thing he needs. She whispers.
I am against quarantine now, like Nippon Jinhack Weevil. If they see my movement, they will know. They will mulch me.
She nestles close.
I am sorry. Please.
Her eyes beg. In a sudden rush of pity, he wraps his arms around her, enfolding her in whatever protection a calorie-man can offer a piece of illegal Japanese trash. The ministry men call out to them, smiling. Anderson smiles back and gives a bob of the head, even as his skin prickles. The white shirt's eyes linger. One of them smiles and says something to the other as he twirls the baton that dangles from his wrist. Emiko shivers uncontrollably beside Anderson, her smile a forced mask. Anderson pulls her closer. Please don't ask for a bribe, not this time, please. They slide past. Behind them, the white shirts start laughing, either about the farang and the girl clutched together, or about something else completely unrelated. And it doesn't matter, really, because they are disappearing into the distance, and he and Emiko are safe again. She draws away, shaking.
Thank you,
she whispers.
I was careless to come out. Stupid.
She pushes her hair away from her face and looks back. The ministry men are quickly receding. Her fists clench.
Stupid girl.
She murmurs.
You are not a Cheshire who disappears as you please.
She shakes her head, angry, driving home her own lesson.
Stupid, stupid, stupid.
Anderson watches transfixed. Emiko is adapted for a different sort of world, not this brutal, sweltering place. The city will swallow her eventually. It's obvious. She becomes aware of his gaze. Shares a small melancholy smile.
Nothing lasts forever, I think.
No.
Anderson's throat is tight. They stare at one another. Her blouse has fallen open again, showing the line of her throat, the inner curve of her breasts. She doesn't move to hide herself, just looks back at him. Solemn. Is it deliberate? Does she mean to encourage him? Or is it simply her nature to entice? Perhaps she cannot help herself at all. A set of instincts as ingrained in her DNA as the Cheshire's clever stalking of birds. Anderson leans close, unsure. Emiko doesn't pull away, moves instead to meet him. Her lips are soft. Anderson runs his hand up her hip, pushes her blouse open and quests inside. She sighs and presses closer, her lips opening to him. Does she wish this, or only acquiesce? Is she even capable of refusing? Her breasts press against him. Her hands slip down his body. He's shaking, trembling, like a 16-year-old boy. Did the geneticists embed her DNA with pheromones? Her body is intoxicating. Mindless of the street, of Lao Gu, of everything, he pulls her to him, running his hand up to cup her breast, to hold her perfect flesh. The wind-up girl's heart speeds like a hummingbird's under his palm. Chapter 11. Jai Di has a certain respect for the Chaozhou Chinese. Their factories are large and well-run. They have generations rooted in the kingdom, and they are intensely loyal to Her Majesty the Child Queen. They are utterly unlike the pathetic Chinese refugees who have flooded in from Malaya, fleeing to his country in hopes of succor after they alienated the natives of their own. If the Malayan Chinese had been half as clever as the Chaozhou, they would have converted to Islam generations ago and woven themselves fully into the tapestry of that society. Instead, the Chinese of Malacca and Penang and the western coast arrogantly held themselves apart, thinking the rising tide of fundamentalism would not affect them. And now they come begging to the kingdom, hoping that their Chaozhou cousins will aid them, when they were not clever enough to help themselves. The Chaozhou are smart, where the Malayan Chinese are stupid. They are practically Thai themselves. They speak Thai. They took Thai names. They may have Chinese roots somewhere in their distant past, but they are Thai, and they are loyal. Which, when Jai Di thinks about it, is more than can be said about some of his own race. Certainly more than can be said of Akarat and his brood at the trade ministry. So Jai Di feels a certain sympathy when a Chaozhou businessman in a long white shirt, loose cotton trousers and sandals, strides back and forth in front of him on the factory floor, complaining that his factory has been shut down because some coal ration has been exceeded, when he paid every white shirt who came through his door, and that Jai Di has no right, to shut down the entire factory. Jai Di even has sympathy when the man calls him a turtle's egg, which is certainly an annoying thing to hear, knowing that it is a terrible insult in Chinese. Yet still he remains tolerant of the emotional explosions on the part of this businessman. It's in the Chinese nature to be a bit hot-hearted. They're given to explosions of emotion that a Thai would never indulge in. All in all, Jai Di has sympathy for the man. But he doesn't have sympathy for a man who shoves a finger into his chest repeatedly while he curses. And so Jai Di is sitting atop that man's chest now, with a black baton over his windpipe, explaining the finer points of respect due to a white shirt. "You seem to have mistaken me for another ministry man," Jai Di observes. The man gurgles and tries to get free, but the baton crushing his throat prevents him. Jai Di watches him carefully. "You of course understand that we have coal rationing because we are a city underwater. Your carbon allocation was exceeded many months ago." Jai Di considers the response, shakes his head sadly. "No, I think that we cannot allow it to continue. King Rama the 12th decreed, and Her Royal Majesty the Child Queen now supports, that we shall never abandon Krung Thep to the invasions of the rising sea. We will not flee from our city of divine beings the way the cowards of Ayutthaya fled from the Burmese. The ocean is not some marching army. Once we accede to the waters, we will never again throw it out. He regards the sweating Chinese man. And so, we must all do our part. We must all fight together, like the villagers of Bang Rajan, to keep this invader from our streets. Don't you think? Good. Jaidi smiles. I'm glad we're making progress. Someone clears his throat. Jaidi looks up, stifling his annoyance.
Yes.
A young private in new whites stands respectfully, waiting.
Kun Jaidi.
He whines, lowering his head to his pressed palms. Holds the pose.
I am very sorry for my interruption.
Yes?
Chao Kun General Pracha requests your presence.
I'm busy, Jaidi says.
Our friend here finally seems willing to communicate with a cool heart and a reasonable demeanor.
He smiles kindly down at the businessman. The boy says,
I was to tell you, I was told to...
Go ahead.
To tell you that you should get glory-seeking ass back to the ministry. Immediately, if not before.
He winces at the words.
If you have no cycle, you were supposed to take mine.
Jaidi grimaces.
Ah. Yes. Well then.
He gets off the businessman, nods to Kanya.
Lieutenant,
perhaps you can reason with our friend here. Kanya makes a face of puzzlement.
Is something wrong?
It seems Pracha is finally ready to rant and rave at me.
Should I come with you?
Kanya glances at the businessman.
This lizard can wait for another day.
Jaidi grins at her concern.
Don't worry about me.
Finish here. I'll let you know whether we're being exiled south to guard yellow card interments for the rest of our careers when you get back. As they head for the door, the businessman musters new bravery.
I'll have your head for this here!
The sound of Kanya's club connecting and a yelp are the last things Jaidi hears as he exits the factory. Outside, the sun glares down. He's already sweating from the exertion of working on the businessman, and the sun burns uncomfortably. He stands under the shade of a coconut palm until the messenger can bring the bike around. The boy eyes Jaidi's sweating face with concern.
You wish to rest?
Jaidi laughs.
Don't worry about me. I'm just getting old.
That here was a troublesome one, and I'm not the fighter I used to be. In the cool season, I wouldn't be sweating so.
You won a lot of fights.
Some,
Jaidi grins.
And I trained in weather hotter than this.
Your lieutenant could do such work, the boy says. No need for you to work so hard.
Jaidi wipes his brow and shakes his head.
And then what would my men think? That I'm lazy?
The boy gasps.
No one would think such a thing of you. Never.
When you're a captain, you'll understand better.
Jaidi smiles indulgently.
Men are loyal when you lead from the front. I won't have a man wasting his time winding a crank fan for me or waving a palm frond just to keep me comfortable like those Hiya in the trade ministry. I may lead, but we are all brothers. When you're a captain, promise me you'll do the same.
The boy's eyes shine. He whines again.
Yes, Kun, I won't forget. Thank you.
Good boy.
Jaidi swings his leg over the boy's bike. When Lieutenant Kanya is finished here, she'll give you a ride back on our tandem. he steers out into traffic. In the hot season, without rain, not many, except the insane or the motivated, are out in the direct heat. But covered arches and paths hide markets full of vegetables and cooking implements and clothing.
Atano na pralan. Jairi takes his hands off the handlebars to Y to the city pillar shrine as he passes, whispering a prayer for the safety of the spiritual heart of Bangkok. It is the place where King Rama XII first announced that they would not abandon the city to the rising seas. Now the sound of monks chanting for the city's survival filters out onto the street, filling Jairi with a sense of peace. He raises his hands to his forehead 3 times, one of a river of other riders who all do the same. 15 minutes later, the Environment Ministry appears, a series of buildings, red-tiled with steeply sloping roofs, peering out of bamboo thickets and teak and rain trees, high white walls, and Garuda and Singh images guard the ministry's perimeter, stained with old rain marks and fringed with growing ferns and mosses. Jairi has seen the compound from the air, one of a handful taken up for a dirigible overflight of the city. When Chayanuchit still ran the ministry, and white shirt influence was absolute, when the plagues that swept the earth were killing crops at such a fantastic rate that no one knew if anything at all would survive. Chayanuchit remembered the beginning of the plagues. Not many could claim that. And when Jairi was just a young draftee, he was lucky enough to work in the man's office, bringing dispatches. Chayanuchit understood what was at stake and what had to be done. When the borders needed closing, when ministries needed isolating, when Phuket and Chiang Mai needed raising, he did not hesitate. When jungle blooms exploded in the north, he burned and burned and burned. And when he took to the sky in His Majesty the King's dirigible, Jairi was blessed to ride with him. By then they were only mopping up. Agrigen and Purcal and the rest were shipping their plague-resistant seeds and demanding exorbitant profits. And patriotic gene rippers were already working to crack the code of the calorie company's products, fighting to keep the kingdom fed as Burma and the Vietnamese and the Khmers all fell. Agrigen and its ilk were threatening embargo over intellectual property infringement. But the Thai kingdom was still alive. Against all odds, they were alive. As others were crushed under the calorie company's heels, the kingdom stood strong.
Embargo? Chayanuchit had laughed. Embargo is precisely what we want. We do not wish to interact with their outside world at all.
And so the walls had gone up.
Those that the oil collapse had not already created. Those that had not been raised against civil war and starving refugees. A final set of barriers to protect the kingdom from the onslaughts of the outside world. As a young inductee, Jairi had been astounded at the hive of activity that was the Environment Ministry. White shirts rushing from office to street as they tried to maintain tabs on thousands of hazards. In no other ministry was the sense of urgency so acute. Plagues waited for no one. A single gene hack weevil found in an outlying district meant a response time counted in hours. White shirts on a Kingspring train rushing across the countryside to the epicenter. And at every turn, the ministry's purview was expanding. The plagues were but the latest insult to the kingdom's survival. First came the rising sea levels, the need to construct the dikes and levees. And then came the oversight of power contracts and trading in pollution credits and climate infractions. The white shirts took over the licensing of methane capture and production. Then there was the monitoring of fishery health and toxin accumulations in the kingdom's final bastion of calorie support. A blessing that the Farang calorie companies thought as landlocked people and had only desultorily attacked fishing stocks. And there was the tracking of human health and viruses and bacteria. H7V9,
Cytoscosis 111 B, C, and D. Phagon fringe. Bitter water mussels and their viral mutations that jumped so easily from salt water to dry land. Blister rust. There was no end to the duties of the ministry. Jaidi passes a woman selling bananas. He can't resist hopping off his bike to buy one. It's a new varietal from the ministry's rapid prototyping unit. Fast-growing, resistant to mock-mock mites with their tiny black eggs that sicken banana flowers before they can hope to grow. He peels the banana and eats it greedily as he pushes his bike along, wishing he could take the time to have a real snack. He discards the peel beside the bulk of a rain tree. All life produces waste. The act of living produces costs, hazards, and disposal questions, and so the ministry has found itself in the center of all life, mitigating, guiding, and policing the detritus of the average person, along with investigating the infractions of the greedy and short-sighted, the ones who wish to make quick profits and trade on others' lives for it. The symbol for the environment ministry is the eye of a tortoise, for the long view, the understanding that nothing comes cheap or quickly without a hidden cost. And if others call them the turtle ministry, and if the Chaozhou Chinese now curse white shirts as turtle's eggs because they are not allowed to manufacture as many Kingspring scooters as they would like, so be it. If the Farang make fun of the tortoise for its slow pace, so be it. The environment ministry has ensured that the kingdom endures, and Jaidi can only stand in awe of its past glories. And yet, when Jaidi climbs off his bicycle outside the ministry gate, a man glares at him and a woman turns away. Even just outside their own compound, or perhaps particularly there, the people he protects turn away from him. Jaidi grimaces and wheels his cycle past the guards. The compound is still a hive of activity, and yet it is so different from when he first joined. There is mold on the walls, and chunks of the edifice are cracking under the pressure of vines. An old bow tree leans against a wall, rotting, underlining their failures. It has lain so for 10 years, rotting. Unremarked amongst the other things that have also died. There is an air of wreckage to the place, of jungle attempting to reclaim what was carved from it. If the vines were not cleared from the paths, the ministry would disappear entirely. In a different time, when the ministry was a hero of the people, it was different. Then people genuflected before ministry officers, 3 times crabbed to the ground, as though they were monks themselves, their white uniforms inspiring respect and adoration. Now Jaidi watches civilians flinch as he walks past. Flinch and run. He is a bully, he thinks sourly. Nothing but a bully, walking amongst water buffalo. And though he tries to herd them with kindness, again and again he finds himself using the whip of fear. The whole ministry is the same. At least those who still understand the dangers that they face, who still believe in the bright white line of protection that must be maintained.
I am a bully.
He sighs and parks the cycle in front of the administrative offices, which are desperately in need of a whitewashing that the shrinking budget cannot finance. Jaidi eyes the building, wondering if the ministry has come to crisis thanks to overreaching or because of its phenomenal success. People have lost their fear of the outside world. Environment's budget shrinks yearly, while that of trade increases. Jaidi finds a seat outside the general's office. White shirt officers walk past, carefully ignoring him. That he is waiting in front of Pracha's office should fill him with some satisfaction. It isn't often that he is called before a man of rank. He's done something right for once. A young man approaches hesitantly, wise.
Kun Jaidi.
At Jaidi's nod, the young man breaks into a grin. His hair is cropped close and his eyebrows are only slight shadows. He has just come out of the monastery.
Kun, I hoped it was you.